Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am Ajito Ryo Master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
Hey there, my Tsunami Generation, and welcome to another episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. I welcome you once again as we continue Disney Month here at the Absolution Network, and on this week's episode, we are covering the 2009 hit classic, or should I say new classic, The Princess and the Frog, which I can personally say, as a fan of animation, when this was coming out, you know, the excitement of having a 2D hand-drawn animation come out from Disney, a return back to what Disney really is, I was ecstatic, and it did not disappoint. So I'm very excited to be reviewing this movie today. We did not have any reviews or emails, so we don't have anything to continue on that boat. I am working on getting iTunes reviews. I know I keep saying at the end of episodes, and that's not forgetting enough. I've done it 3 times. iTunes has rejected it 3 times. It has to be something to do with the actual feed itself that's wrong. I have no idea. So I'm still trying to work that out. I know people like to have podcasts on iTunes. So, let's get right into this movie. As I said, it's The Princess and the Frog, which was released in 2009. 2D hand-drawn animation. Let's start off with cast, shall we? We have Anika Nori-Rose as Tiana, also drawn as Marquand. I made sure, actually, by the way, to also mention with some of these characters that are artists, as they will be important to talk about later. Bruno Campos is Prince Naveen, and is drawn by Randy Haycock. Keith David plays Dr. Facilite, also aka the Voodoo Man, or I should say the Shadow Man, drawn by Bruce W. Smith. Michael Leon Woodley plays Lewis, the trumpet-playing alligator, drawn by Eric Goldberg, who some of you might know as the artist who drew the genie in Aladdin. Okay, we'll get to all that later. Jim Cummings, the legendary voice acting pantheon god Jim Cummings, plays Ray, the Firefly, drawn by Michael Sree. Jennifer Lewis plays the voodoo goddess, or voodoo priestess, shall I say, Mama Odie, drawn by the legendary Andreas Deja. Jennifer Cody plays Charlotte Loti LaBouffe. Peter Barlett plays Lawrence, Prince Naveen's butler. John Goodman plays Eli LaBouffe, a.k.a. Big Daddy LaBouffe. Oprah Winfrey plays Eudora, Tiana's mother. And Terrence Howard plays James, Tiana's father. Directed by John Musker and Ron Clements, a.k.a. the same directors of A Great Mouse Detective, The Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Hercules, and Treasure Planet. So, these guys know what the hell they're doing. Music by Randy Newman. On to synopsis. Our story takes place at the turn of the 20th century, as, you know, where Woodrow Wilson's just been elected and all that type of stuff, in the gem of the Mississippi, New Orleans. I love New Orleans, Lawful Sam. But anyways, it follows a young hardworking African-American woman named Tiana, whose dream is to open up a restaurant and sell her and her father's cooking, who has unfortunately passed away. While she is at a party for her friend Charlotte LaBeouf, who's part of the LaBeouf family, who's one of the richest in New Orleans, she messes up her shirt and she has to get changed, and there she runs into a talking frog who claims to be Prince Naveen, the same person who Charlotte downstairs is supposed to be dancing with. He then reveals that he had run into a man named the Shadow Man, a.k.a. Dr. Facilite, who had conned him and his butler, Lawrence, and had turned him into a frog and Lawrence into him. He then convinces Tiana to kiss him, saying that if she kisses him and helps him turn back human, because he thinks she's a princess, that he will give her the money to help open up her restaurant and complete her dream. She does, but being that she's not a princess, she's turned into a frog. After causing some chaos at the party, Tiana and Naveen find themselves in the bayou, where they run into Louis, a trumpet-toting alligator who dreams of one day playing with the big boys, and Raymond, or as he likes to call himself, Ray, the firefly, like I said, voiced by the legendary Jim Cummings. And they proceed to make their way to Mama Odie, a voodoo priestess in the bayou. Meanwhile, Dr. Facilite requests help from his friends on the other side to hunt down Prince Naveen, as he needs his blood to keep the transformation of Lawrence as Prince Naveen going. While this is happening, Lawrence, as Prince Naveen, has asked Charlotte to marry him, and they proceed to say that they are going to have their wedding on Mardi Gras. Back with Tiana and Naveen, after escaping frog hunters and shadows sent by Dr. Facilite, they find themselves to Mama Odie, who, after trying to tell them about what they need, the difference between what they need and what they want, tells them that for Naveen and Tiana to turn themselves human again, Naveen needs to kiss Charlotte, who at that very moment has become a princess, since her father, Big Daddy LaBeouf, is the king of the Mardi Gras parade. They make their way to a riverboat and travel towards New Orleans. While this is going on, Naveen has discovered that he has fallen in love with Tiana through their travels to Mama Odie and back, and tries to propose to her, but is captured by Facilite's shadows, where more of his blood is drawn to keep up his appearance as Naveen. At Mardi Gras, Tiana is searching for Naveen, but only sees Lawrence, who looks like Naveen human, about to marry Charlotte, and goes running off in sadness. Meanwhile, Ray finds the real Naveen, who is locked up in a treasure chest on the float, and manages to free him just in time for the frog Naveen to stop Lawrence from marrying Charlotte. Naveen manages to get a hold of the amulet that is helping Lawrence appear like Naveen, and gives it to Ray, who goes off to find Tiana. He manages to get the amulet to Tiana, but unfortunately dies upon the hands of Dr. Facilite doing this. Dr. Facilite tries to con Tiana into giving him back the amulet by, you know, saying that, you know, give me the amulet, I will give you all that you dream. But Tiana comes to understand exactly what Mama Odie was trying to tell her about what she needed, and instead breaks the amulet, which therefore causes all of Facilite's friends on the other side to want him to pay off the debt, and, you know, eliminating Dr. Facilite. Naveen manages to find Charlotte and tells him about his plight, and she eventually agrees to kiss him without any need of marriage, but unfortunately kisses him too late, as midnight has come and she is no longer a princess. Tiana and Naveen make their way back to the bayou, where after a funeral for Ray, they proceed to get married and find out that upon marrying, Tiana has become a princess and kissing her turns them back human. They then get married for real, buy Tiana's restaurant, and they live happily ever after. The end. that's it for synopsis. I hope I did the movie justice. With that, let's start our review of Walt Disney's The Princess and the Frog.
In the Southland, there's a city way down on the river where the women are very pretty and all the men deliver. They got music, it's always playing. Start in the daytime, go all through the night. When you hear that music playing, hear what I'm saying, it make you feel alright. Grab some body, come on down. Bring your paintbrush, we painting the town. Oh, there's some sweetness going round. Can't you down in New Orleans?
So let's start a review, and as we always do, we start off with music. Let's start off by talking about Randy Newman's score and how it captures the spirit of New Orleans, because there's a lot of different musical styles here. There's jazz, there's blues, there's the xylophone, which is the first time I've ever heard it. It's that sort of tradition, sort of that type of music you hear in New Orleans. I actually never knew that was his name, but that's something I learned upon doing research. But yeah, I mean, it's all the types of music, mind you hear in New Orleans. You know, there's blues, there's jazz, there's gospel, there's iPhone. It's the spirit of Southern music. And it, again, has that American feel, American quality to the music itself. I think one great place where you hear this is actually at the end of the movie, where they're getting married, and it's sort of more of a traditional score, but you sort of hear those sort of New Orleans notes in there, you know. And that's something about the overall score. I mean, besides the songs themselves, which also do a great job, but the music in and around the series, you know, that it's not the song, sort of the more traditional orchestra music that's in more poignant scenes. They fit sort of the American, and more importantly, sort of that New Orleans style of music. The notes themselves, the way the notes are and the way they play sort of fits around the theme of notes that you would hear in jazz music and blues music and gospel and all of that sort of American Southern music. And at the same time, a lot of the instruments, if you actually listen, are, again, instruments you would hear in sort of music in the South. Banjos and I'm blanking on the name of those little guitars that you actually see Naveen playing. But also the trumpet and the trombones and sort of the big brass that you hear in Southern United States music. I'm trying to, like, deafen the reason. And I do kind of know about this since I kind of lived in the South for the past 20 years of my life. I heard a lot of this music, so I definitely hear the notes there that is used in a lot of Southern music. Overall, when it comes to the score, I do enjoy it. I definitely think the songs themselves outdo the score. It's not like the scores of Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and like in sort of the early stuff where the score outside of the songs, I mean, even though the songs shine so much, the sort of interlude music is also just as beautiful, even if it doesn't give, if it isn't given the chance, to stand out on its own. Here, it's good. I enjoy it, but there's just that one thing missing that's really, that really separates that, the orchestra pieces during the movie to that next level, I think. Now, with that being said, the songs during the movie are definitely right up there, I feel, with songs from The Little Mermaid and, Beauty and the Beast. I don't think they're as good as the songs as that, but they're at that same level. If I was doing, or giving awards, mind you, of which song was better, it'd definitely go to those songs, because there's just a thing about those songs. I'll be talking about those songs again next week. But here, these are wonderful songs, and I think part of the charm about them, especially being from the South, is just different styles that each song takes. So with that, let's go down the list of the songs that are in this movie. We start with the first song that we hear, which is Down in New Orleans. It's Dr. John with Randy Newman on piano. It's just that sort of classic sort of Southern jazz number, in the Southland. There's a city way down on the river where the women are very pretty and all the men deliver. We got music, it's always playing, starting the daytime, go all through the night. And when you hear the music playing, it makes you dance and may feel alright, yeah. Da-da-da-da-da. Grab somebody and come on down. Grab a paint bus, we're painting the town. We got some sweetness going around. Catch it down in New Orleans. Da 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 da. Da da da. I mean, Dr. John singing this song is absolutely beautiful. I mean, and as you heard with the lyrics there, it's just wonderful. It's sort of that. Just great sort of classic. It makes you think of New Orleans. It's just wonderful like that. I think one of my favorite parts of the song is towards the end where it goes, stately homes and mansions of the sugar barons and the cotton kings. Rich people, poor people, all got dreams. Dreams do come true in New Orleans. Which is, again, the end of the song. But I sort of love how, or should I say, one of the reasons I love that part of the song is that it's a transition of basically telling the stories that you're about to hear. Because at the same time, sort of like a Broadway set, because again, this is a move more towards, again, that Broadway-style musical type of story. And that scene, you see Tiana, you see Naveen, you see the Voodoo Man, Dr. Facilite, you see all of them. And it sort of moves into that story about what sort of the magic that is New Orleans, that everybody has a dream. And of probably any city in the United States, New Orleans is probably the most magical city, at least in this time in history, of the United States of America. It's the closest thing to that fairy tale city. It's rich people and poor people, they all got dreams. Dreams do come true in New Orleans. It immediately brings you into that thought process, this being this city of magic and extraordinary things. So, I definitely love that song. Let's move on to Almost There. This is Tiana's song, sort of the Princeton song, where she talks about what she wants. And again, it just backs up everything you love about Tiana as, it goes deep into sort of her hardworking attitude and, how she's following her dream on the thought process that you can't rely on wishing stars. You have to rely on your hard work. She can't go dancing and, all this stuff because, she has to achieve her dream and she's just almost there. Yeah, and by the way, I love how they sort of segue into the song. There's a very organic flow from the story, from the conversation that Udanda and Tiana, are having, that just flows naturally. He goes, Mama, I ain't got time for dancing. That's just gonna have to take a while. Ain't got time for messing around. That's not my style. This old town can tear you down. People taking the easy way. But I know exactly where I'm going. Closer and closer every day, and I'm almost there. I'm almost there. It's just an organic flow there. And then, of course, the animation during the song, which is Harlem Renaissance, which is just beautiful. And sort of telling the story of Tiana's dream, what her restaurant's going to be, what she's trying to accomplish. And the lyrics themselves are absolutely beautiful. I think my favorite lyric is, I've climbed the mountain, I've crossed the river, and I'm almost there. along with, you know, of course, the middle of the song where she starts talking about her father, which, and again, that also as well tells the story of her love with her father, which you saw at the beginning of the film, but this just reaffirms it. Because, you know, I remember Daddy told me fairy tales can come true, but you gotta make them happen. They all depend on you. So I work real hard and eat every day so that things will go my way. Doing just what I do. Look out, world, I'm coming through. You know, again, it reaffirms, you know, her love for her father, but also sort of that different idea of, you know, what has sort of been traditionally of the, you know, the wishing of the star, the believing in the dream, something that is sort of that traditional Disney tradition. That's a word there, traditional Disney tradition of, you know, the wishing the star and things just happening. You know, she's a hard worker. She doesn't believe in the idea of that just because you wish upon a star that dreams can come true. And again, we'll get more into this, into the themes of the series, back in story. But, again, she believes that it can only be accomplished with hard work. Another reason I love this is, I think that's a very American fundamental idea. You know, and I think that helps you bring you into sort of this being an American fairy tale. This idea of, you know, it can only be accomplished through working hard. That's a very fundamental American idea. You know, this idea that, you know, I'm going to go out every day, bust my ass at my job, and my dreams will come true. So I love that part of the song. And just all of it makes such a wonderful song. The animations in it are wonderful. And I have to say this. I love at the end to where they go out the door and then that little pedestal falls. It's just a little laugh, but I just love it. Now we move on to what is my favorite song in the movie, the villain song. To be honest, I'm more of a hopeless romantic. So a lot of times, my favorite songs are, you know, sort of the more romantic songs. You know, Beauty and the Beast, Kiss the Girl, Whole New World, you know, Colors in the Wind. You know, I personally love those songs. But in this movie, my favorite is, bar none, Friends on the Other Side. I love everything about this song, the music, the animation. You know, Keith David does a wonderful freaking job doing this song. You know, it, again, for those who may not remember the name Keith David, if you remember Gargoyles, he was Goliath on Gargoyles. So, yeah. And, of course, so many other things. I gotta be careful when I talk about voice acting, because I go off into things. But yeah, Friends on the Other Side, you know, just, and again, it's another one of those songs that has that organic flow into it from the conversation to where he's trying to con Lawrence and, you know, Naveen, and he's going, "Don't you disrespect me, little man! Don't you delegate or derive. You're in my world now, not the old world. And I've got friends on the other side." And then you hear the echo, "He's got friends on the other side." And you have that little talk there, go, "Don't be afraid." That's a little echo, this little parlor trick we got in New Orleans. "Don't worry. Sit down at my table. Put your mind at ease. And it will enable me to do anything I please. I can read your future. I can take you around some too. I look deep into your heart and soul. You do got a soul, don't you, Lawrence? Make your wildest dreams come true. I got voodoo, I got hoodoo, I got things I'd even tried. And I've got friends on the other side." And again, going to the animation to where the shadow acts independently from him, and just, and this goes towards Bruce W. Smith's, you know, animation of him. The sleazy, slick way he moves like a snake. It's awesome. And then, of course, you have the wonderful, the song changes a bit in the middle to where, you know, he's reading the tarot cards and, you know, and he's telling their past, present, and, you know, "You young men are from across the sea. You come from two long lines of royalty. I'm a royal myself on my mother's side. Your lifestyle's high, but your funds are low. You need to marry a little honey whose daddy got dough. Mom and dad cut you off, ain't they, playboy? So now you gotta get hitched, but hitching ties you down. You wanna be free, hop from place to place, but freedom takes green. It's the green you need. And when I look into your future, it's the green that I see. I could continue singing this song all day. I love it that much. And it, you know, of course, and then Lawrence, where you had sort of that flip book effect with the cards, and him doing these sort of parlor tricks with the tarot cards, they're just wonderful. And mind you, it's telling the story of his con. And that's the great thing about this, is rather than it just, you know, or should I say, exactly kind of like Ursula's villain song is sort of a con song where it's telling the story of the con of Ariel. Here you have the con of both Naveen and Lawrence. Or should I say, the con of Naveen, being that he's naive and convincing, and or should I say, Facilite is convincing, and sort of side conversation as if to have with Lawrence, like, I'm going to sort of con him, and if you partner with me, I'll get you everything you want. You know, it's that con of both Naveen and Lawrence, while at the same time sort of being that plotting with Lawrence, and it tells that story perfectly. And of course, then you have the ending, you know, are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? You know, and it's straight out of, you know, Pink Elephants, you know, the penguins from Mary Poppins. It's that just big, brash, and jazz ending to the song. And just the way it ends with him, you know, if you have a problem with that, don't blame me. You can blame my friends on the other side. And you hear in the background, you got what you wanted, but you lost what you had. And I think people missed that of the song, but it's very important. Again, it just reaffirms exactly what, you know, the whole theme of the story and what that song is about, you know, what you need besides what you want. You know, here you're going after what you want, but in getting what you want, or since in getting what Prince Naveen and what Lawrence want, they lost what they had. They had to give up something to get what they wanted. So, I love this song. You don't know how many times I play it. You know, I play it usually on a daily rotation. You know? Yeah, there's songs I'll listen to every day, and this is one of them. That's how good it is. The next song is We're Human, and this is where they meet Lewis, and they're going after Mama Odie, and Sven basically saying, you know, oh, once we see Mama Odie and, you know, get everything straightened out, this is what we're going to do. You know, Lewis wants to play the trumpet with the big boys. Naveen wants to go back to being a philanthropist playboy. You know, Tiana, you know, she's going to go back to working hard and get her restaurant. You know, and it's another great jazz number. You know, and with the Dr. Johnsons, it's sort of blues and jazz, you know. Friends on the Other Side was, you know, sort of a jazz number. Almost there was a blues and jazz number. I mean, this is just straight up jazz. And it's, you know, again, telling the stories about what they want. What they think they want. I mean, stuff that they learn that they don't necessarily need later in the story. But again, you know, sort of the dreams of our three characters here. I think it is probably the weakest song in the movie, but that by no means it's bad. It's a very good song, and I love it. You know, again, I love the way it starts with the trumpet, you know, if I was a human being, I'd head straight for New Orleans, and I'd blow this horn so loud and hey, like no one's ever seen. Hey there, Louis Armstrong, Mississippi for say, and all these guys, and hear Gator play. I blanked on the last words there. And of course, it has a lot of comedy in it to where, you know, the sort of the abuse of the turtle there, which is supposed to be Randy Newman was going to apparently be in this song as the turtle saying, "Are you sure about that? Are you sure about that? Are you sure about that?" But that got cut. They wanted to have Randy Newman at some point in the movie because, again, it's sort of a Pixar thing, and they wanted to... And again, that's something all in this movie is... We'll talk about that later. Is there's, like, references to different artists and the directors, and there's even a reference to Hayao Miyazaki. But, yeah, but this song, it's just that sort of pop, sort of adventure travel song done to the style of jazz, and... We're going to get another one after that, and I think that's maybe one of the reasons the next two songs aren't probably the best in the movie, is that they are both sort of that, those travel songs, and they're good, I enjoy them, but, and while this one moves the story more along, being one after another feels like maybe they didn't understand what to put in there, but at the same point in time, it doesn't really slow down the movie much. It actually moves the story forward, so I can't fault it that much. Like I said, the next song is I'm Gonna Take You There, and I apologize if I say the name of this style, but it's the xylophone style. It's that sort of traditional, when you think of New Orleans, you go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That sort of traditional music that people think of when they think of New Orleans. Is the style of this song, and it's, you know, when they meet Ray and, you know, sort of talking about the bayou and, you know, the beauty and the magic of the bayou in this song, it's a very beautiful song. Gonna take you there, we're gonna take you there, we're gonna take you all the way there. We're gonna take you there, we're gonna take you there, we're gonna take you all the way. Going down the bayou, going down the bayou, going down the bayou, taking you all the way. Y'all, it's a very simple song. I think that's one of the gems about it, is that it's a simple song. And I think any travel song needs to be a simple song. But again, it's them traveling towards Mama Odie. The next song we have is the love song of the movie, Ma Belle Evangeline. And as they put it, sort of a Cajun... love song is what the movie creators said they wanted with this. And it's very much of a beautiful song. It's in this song you capture the spirit of the romance of New Orleans, I think. And Jim Cummings does a wonderful job singing it. You know, the integrating of French terms and all of that, you know, which is in the spirit of a sort of Cajun. Again, I'm not from New Orleans, I'm from Tampa, but I can only go off what people have told me about it. So, they've said that it does follow in that spirit. At the same point in time, I love how, in this song, you're sort of told the story of this romance between Tiana and Naveen. It's an integral part of telling how they're starting to fall in love. Naveen, you know, Tiana takes a bit more time, but here's where Naveen is starting to realize... You know, he's having feelings for Tiana and, you know, what she means to him. You know, as he gets revealed later, as we're going to talk about in a second, mind you, when we talk about Dig a Little Deeper. But again, he's starting to realize that, and this is where they're starting to fall in love. And again, this idea of, on this adventure to become human, they fall in love with each other. Which is a very traditional and simple story that has been done before, but it's done to great execution here. And I very much love that about that. Now we move on to what is my second favorite song of the movie. Because I love gospel. And this is the gospel song by Mama Odie by Jennifer Lewis. Dig a Little Deeper. Don't matter what you look like. Don't matter what you are. None of it don't matter. Rant a finger. Blah, blah, blah. Doesn't matter how you wrench the finger. We don't care. No, we don't care. Doesn't even matter what you are. A cow, a pig, a dog. Had them all in here. Had them all. And they knew what they wanted. What they wanted, need to do. I told them what they needed. Just like I be telling you. You gotta dig a little deeper. Well, it's gonna be tough. You gotta dig a little deeper. Tell mama I told you so. Once you find out what you need, you find out who you are, dig a little deeper and you'll know. And I messed up lyrics, which is embarrassing. But it's this wonderful sort of gospel song to where you here you have the fairy godmother, the sort of the person who's helping our characters on their way, you know, sort of preaching to them about, you know, what you're going after is what you want. It's not what you need. And if you look right in front of it, if you slow down, look around you, and look right in front of you, and dig within yourself, you'll find out all that you really need. You don't need to necessarily be human. What you need is a solution to your problems. And it's right in front of it. It's what you need. You know, with Naveen, again, it's that self-control. And to the extent, that idea of what he needs is a good woman to complete him. He doesn't need the money because it didn't help him before. You know, Froggy was a rich little man. You want to be rich again. Money didn't make you happy. Now, did won't make you happy now. Did it make you happy then? No. Money ain't got no soul. Money ain't got no heart. All you need some self-control. Make yourself a brand new frog. You know, again, and really, that was the simple solution. If he had just married Tiana there and kissed her, they would have turned human. But again, they had to learn that the hard way. But and again, also with Tiana, because she was the more difficult. You know, she was so headstrong, so caught on the idea that completing your dreams takes hard work. You can't just wish upon a star. That she didn't see what was right in front of her. She didn't see that what her father's real dream was bringing people together. The food was just a thing that helped accomplish that goal. His dream wasn't necessarily just to open a restaurant. The restaurant and the food and everything was to the point of bringing people together, because that was what made making that food so wonderful, was the people coming together, the community coming together, the community being one, and being surrounded by friends and family. And that's what she needed. And Tiana just didn't understand that. It took her to learn that, to understand that. But yeah, and again, all these things are told in this song, and it's such a wonderful song. I love gospel music, personally. I mean, it just hits all the right notes and everything. And within the song, you know, it's the thing of, it shows the beauty and the grace of gospel. So anyways, yeah, I love this song. And let's move on to our final song, which is sort of the reprieve song, which is Down in New Orleans, sung by Tiana at the end, at the happy ending, you know, in the Southland is a city down by the river. I mean, it's the same lyrics, but, you know, and it sort of puts the end, and it just, again, it has one of my favorite scenes where Charlotte's, you know, apparently, supposedly dancing with the prince's ring. I didn't know the prince had a younger brother. How old did you say you were? I'm 9 and a half. I've waited this long. And it's like, that's Charlotte. But yeah, I absolutely love this song. It's a great way to end the movie. And it's this uplifting song that sort of the happy ending, and of course the fireflies going off. I think it was the right choice, the way to end the city, or I should say end the movie, mind you. So yeah, I absolutely love this song. We do have one more song in the movie. It's not technically part of the movie, but it's during the credits, and it's the, sort of the pop song that goes with the movie. Neo's Never Knew I Needed, and I actually like it. And what I like is that the song really accomplishes everything that is about the movie. It's a great credit song, and it's a great song in general, and I love Neo singing, by the way, so yeah, I very much enjoyed the song. That's it, mind you, for music, and we're going to move on to animation right after a word from our sponsors.
December 7th.
Earth 2.
1941.
A world very much like our own, yet slightly different.
A date which will live in infamy.
A world at war.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Following the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt brought together the largest group of mystery men ever assembled to battle the Axis powers. Tales of the Justice Society of America presents the All-Star Squadron.
The Tales of the Justice Society of America, every Friday at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
And welcome back, and let's get started on animation, shall we? First talking point that we're going to cover here is the overall style of The Princess and the Frog. Now, if I had to link a certain artistic style with, you know, this movie, it'd be the French impressionistic style that is actually common in New Orleans. So it does go sort of with the art style that you see in New Orleans paintings and even went into architecture a bit. I don't want to go, because the impressionist style really didn't go into architecture. But again, all those influences from French art and this being one of them within New Orleans art. So it definitely feels in the spirit of New Orleans, which, you know, the funny thing about that is, really, that is the point. It's not about actually being New Orleans, rather than displaying the spirit of New Orleans within the art of this film. And you see it in the backgrounds, you see it in the character designs, you see it in everything. It's, you know, everything that's portrayed, it's not about the, not that they're, you know, all making stuff up or anything. I mean, they are referencing, you know, things that happen in New Orleans. And for instance, you know, the early in the film, you see the jazz band that goes down the street. You know, they're not referencing any particular band, but those group of people are the spirit of the people that, you know, do those things on a daily basis in New Orleans. Spirit sounds like they're, you know, they've passed away, but I mean, like, it's in the spirit of, you know, the jazz players who walk down the street. Everything is about that, you know, sort of French impressionistic style art-wise about the spirit, or should I say the spirit of New Orleans. Spirit, I forgot they had New Orleans in that part. That's here north there. But again, when you go, or should I say when they are in, you know, the breakfast place, you know, where Tiana works, it's about the spirit of what, you know, those type of shops in New Orleans are. You know, when they show the Mardi Gras parade, it's about showing the spirit of what the Mardi Gras parade is about. Sans boobies. Because this is a Disney film. And then again, boobies I don't think had integrated into Mardi Gras in the early 1900s. In fact, I'd actually be interested to know when did boobies make it into Mardi Gras, because that was a grand day. It's one of those days where God looks down and goes, "That's right." Oh, I'm going to get some emails on that one, aren't I? Note to self, you're not Bill Maher. But, yeah, that's besides the point. But again, you know, you get my point. It's in that French Impressionist style, and I do enjoy it because it is the spirit of New Orleans. It's the art style that you do see commonly within the painting styles that you would see in New Orleans. And I think they do it to a wonderful point. You know, they integrate it well into all areas of the art and animation. And it definitely makes this movie feel like it's made in New Orleans. So I think that's the important part there. With that, let's move on to character designs, and we're going to start off with our main character, Tiana. Now, one thing to say with all these character designs, again, sort of soft lines. Not that there isn't, you know, that typical Disney style, because that's there, but again, it's integrated into that impressionist style. And you have a bit of soft lines here, soft strokes within the character designs. That being said, we're going to go into the individual pieces here. I love the design of Tiana. I love that you can feel within her design, that you can feel the sort of the hardworking attitude that is a part of her character. You know, I love that, you know, when you look at the way she dresses, you know, the sort of the hand-me-downs, you know, because they're torn and a little ragged in places. And I love that, you know, again, like I said, it shows her hardworking attitude, but at the same point in time, it also leads into, you know, her personality and tells the story of her personality. And then on the flip side of that is then you have the beauty of her character design that you see in, well, you know, for instance, at the end where she's in that princess gown when, you know, the kiss, also the sort of Southern Belle dress, you know, at the party, you see how the colors perfectly accentuate her character design. You know, great use of colors with the light blues, you know, and of course those sky blues and sort of light greens at the end dress. It perfectly accentuates her character design, so I love that. Moving on to her frog form, I love the feminine qualities of her frog form. Just there's a softness to design that I very much enjoy. That's very different from what typically, you know, frogs would be made like. And so I very much enjoy that part of the design. I love the softness. I love the feminine quality. I love the fact that you can completely understand why Naveen, when they're frogs, is falling in love with Tiana. It's more than its outward appearance. It's her design brings her great inward qualities outward. And so you understand why Naveen is falling in love with her. You know, that's a big part of it. With that being said, let's move on to Prince Naveen. I love sort of the playboyish design of him in his human form, from the way he dresses and everything. You know, you get a sense of this sort of playboyish, yeah, he's cocky and like flaunted everything. It's not one of those, you know, oh, bad, like, oh, here comes that playboy, Naveen. It's like, oh, there's a, you know, it's not like that, you know, thing where people might say when they see Bruce Wayne. It's, you know, it's funny we're talking about playboy. It's more of that Hugh Hefner type of thing. Which, I have to explain what I mean when I say that. You know, when Hugh Hefner comes out, you know, he's a playboy, but he seems like a normal guy when you meet him. Except for the fact that he's in, you know, a red bathrobe. But, you know, it's that same type of feeling here with Naveen to where, yeah, he's playboyish and you know, somewhat of a jerk, but at the same point in time, he does come off as that normal guy. To put it in sort of a context, you know, if he was running for office here in the United States, which everybody seems to be doing this election cycle, he would be that guy that people would like because they feel like they could have a beer with him. You know, it's that sort of normal quality that you're drawn into. And I think that work, you know, it all comes from his character design. Again, the story being told within the character design. And then in frog form, you know, I'm Michael J. Frog, which, I know it's a Michael J. something, but the frog from the Warner Brothers cartoons is what I'm very much reminded of when I see his frog design, especially when there are a couple scenes where, you know, he looks at the camera, and it just automatically takes me back to, you know, those Warner Brother cartoons where you go, hello, my darling, hello, my baby, da-da-da-da-da-da. I mean, I can fully see him having a top hat and cane and dancing. Which, again, I think works very well, you know, considering that there's a lot of dancing when there are frogs. Another thing I like about his, you know, frog design, again, you see sort of the broad, you know, Naveen in human form has broad shoulders. You see sort of those broad shoulders in his frog form. And then the other thing is those three stripes that are on each of his leg. I think it just makes his design very distinct. And for whatever reason, and I just can't put my finger on it, but it makes it feel like Naveen. You know, it's very distinct. It makes this frog design different. Let's move on to Dr. Facilite. God, I love this design. I love the color scheme. I love the purple and black immediately. It definitely does bring me into that idea of voodoo, but I love sort of the top hat and the coat and sort of the purple shirt underneath and everything. And it's just like, you know, everything about design screams voodoo, especially the way he moves. Not that, okay, I want to set this straight right now. Not that I think that, you know, people voodoo naturally move like this, because I think one thing that Disney does great with this film is that it portrays both parts with Mama Odie and Dr. Facilite. I mean, obviously they couldn't go into the religion of voodoo, but, you know, they were going into what the spirits were and, you know, how it could be used in a magical sense. But with him being the villain, the way they made him move slimy and slick and, you know, just the way his shadow moved independently, which was such a brilliant idea. And just the sort of the free form flow of his shadow. You know, it's in his shape and yet it has no boundaries. It can move on its own and turn into different things. And I just love it. This character is so fun to watch on screen. Just looking at his design, because of the way the shadow moves and, you know, the way he moves and sort of the slick sliminess of his character movements, you know. One way I point this out is there's a scene to where Lawrence is having second thoughts about, you know, this facade of being Naveen, and he, you know, doesn't want to do it, and so Facilite has to convince him again. And, you know, puts it, and he finally goes, "And just think, when we get that LeBeau fortune, we'll cut it right down the middle." And then he moves his hand in front of his mouth to go, 60-40, just like I said. And it's that, like, little slimy, slick little movement, like moving your hand in front of your face like I just did right there. If I move my hand in front of my face, it will make you ignore my mistakes or ignore the things I say, like, saying it'll be right down the middle, again, it's 60-40. Just that little slick, slimy sort ofness of his character. I absolutely love it. And that's so well animated by Bruce W. Smith. Next, we have Lewis and Ray. And, of course, Lewis was done by Eric Goldberg. And, then, of course, Ray by Michael Soray. But, of course, you know, Eric Goldberg, who did the genie in Aladdin, as I said before. And you definitely see some qualities of sort of that fun attitude of the genie in Lewis. Eric Goldberg did a wonderful job animating him. I love the sort of the contrast you see it in both color and in shape between Lewis and the alligators that you're introduced before his introduction. I love the contrast between them. There's just a sort of big comfortness that's within his character design that I very much like. You know, you enjoy being in his company, even though he's this big alligator who can be dangerous. You know, and that's really the power of the Disney animation, which is this ability to have a character who is this dangerous animal, like an alligator or a tiger or whatever, and make it feel warm and cuddly and everything. Which I'm sure is no surprise to anybody, but again, like I said, I love his color scheme. I love how he's, it's just, I want to say swamp green, but it's a very lighter form of green, as I said before, of those other alligators. And it makes him stand out on the background, which I very much enjoy. And then with Ray, you know, I don't want to get too much into Ray's, but, you know, I just love sort of how, again, he's in that, he's a firefly, but yet he's made into that spirit of the Cajun. I think that was very smart to do. The fact that, you know, they decided to make him Cajun. He's very funny to look at, you know. Again, warm and cuddly, and I very much enjoy it for that reason. Next, we have Mama Odie and Andreas Deja, who's, you know, I know him so well for doing so many of the classic villains that we saw in the 90s, whether it be Gaston and Jafar and Ursula, and I believe he did Scar. I could be wrong on that, but I know he did Voldorf in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and so on. You know, he's known for doing villains. For him to do basically the Fairy Godmother, which is such a change from what he usually does, and he does it so well. I love the color scheme on Mama Odie, and I love how it's such a... I love how you do have that great, bright contrast between Mama Odie and Dr. Facilite, him being mostly black, her being mostly white. So I love that contrast. I love sort of... And he got some of this from the dancers, you know, that he used as reference for that scene. But sort of the shimmy and the way he moves, you know... Of Mama Odie, you know, she very much reminds me of sort of that old woman of the church, you know, that everybody looks up to and everybody respects. And I love that quality of her. And then, of course, you have her her sidekick, Juju. I love how, you know, with Dr. Facilite, you had sort of that slimy little snake-like, but it was more like a water snake. Juju was... I really felt it was sort of in that spirit of kind of what Ka was in, you know, Jungle Book, you know, in the way he could shapeshift and form different shapes and everything. And even when he's being changed to different animals, he still retains those sort of snake-like sort of shapeshift qualities that I very much like. Final characters we're going to talk about is Charlotte Lawrence and Big Daddy LeVou. You know, I love these characters. You know, they're supporting characters. I love that you tell the stories within the characters. You know, with Charlotte, I love how she's sort of like this parody of the Disney princess when you really think about it. You know, there's a scene where she looks like Cinderella. Of course, you have the dancey scene between her and the fake Naveen, which is taken straight out of Sleeping Beauty. But it always seems like, you know, she's parodying the Disney princess, which I like. Sort of the, you know, and it's a great contrast to Tiana's design. You know, where Tiana's more of this more modern, traditional princess. You know, Charlotte's design really goes around that sort of traditional idea of the fairy tale princess, the Cinderellas, the Snow Whites, and Sleeping Beauties, and so on. Lawrence, you sort of have that bumbling, goofy design. You know, I'm very reminded of Fo from Beauty and the Beast when I look at his design, sort of the short and things, and sort of the way, you know, it's when in doubt, hit him. but I enjoy his design too. And then Big Daddy Eli, it's a matter of, you know, he, again, that sort of worn and cuddly and sort of that, it's sort of a great parody of sort of that old King Cole effect that I think I get from him design-wise, so I very much enjoy that. With that, let's move on to next talking point. We're going to talk about the special effects. I love the special effects in this. You know, I've watched this movie numerous times just watching the special effects because the way, you know, the sparkles in the sky and then, of course, ripples on the water and the different things they do. It's Disney special effects at its best. And this is one of those things you just can't really do in a CG film. And what I mean by that is, I mean, you can do special effects. But again, this is one of those instances where the special effects in a 2D hand-drawn film has a bit more soul than it does in a CG film. You know, in a CG film, especially with them being 3D, you know, you can... The special effects sometimes feel as they're gimmicky, you know? But here, it's a soul. It's so well integrated into the scene and a part of the scene. And the special effects are so important for a 2D animation to bring you into the scene and what's happening into the scene. That there's a bit of soul within the special effects. And they're just so wonderful here. It's a beauty to see whether it's raining or lightning to sunshine and sort of the reflections off mirrored surfaces. It's great quality, great attention to detail there, and I very much enjoy it. And last but not least, let's talk about backgrounds. And again, this is another instance to where this is about the soul of 2D hand-drawn animation and the ability, of what Disney does best, especially considering, like I said before, this is one of those starting points that really started me thinking towards Disney 2D hand-drawn animation, especially in the 90s and on, being anime. You know, the backgrounds, the depth that you feel in the backgrounds, the fact that you feel that you can go into the background and you're actually in a world and you can continue traveling, whether it be deep into the bayou or, walking down the streets of New Orleans when they're in, New Orleans. And again, it goes to that impressionist style, which is used perfectly here. The fact that, again, being that it's in the spirit, you feel like you are in the bayou. You feel like you are in New Orleans or in a stately mansion house or whatever the scene may be. It brings you into that depth. It was great to see that. It was great. I believe they did it a different way with computers, but again, sort of that classic, Disney multi-layered camera look was brought here, which very much helped it. So, yeah, the backgrounds are just absolutely gorgeous. That's it for animation, and we'll be right back with story after a word from our sponsors.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
And welcome back. And let's move on to the story, shall we? First talking point we're going to talk about is the overall theme of the movie, and which is... what you want against what you need. The importance of understanding the difference between the two. You have this grand adventure of Tiana and Naveen, and, both of them are sort of lost in the idea, thought of what they think they want. Not understanding of what they need, and sort of the lesson learned of, what you need is right before you. And this idea, this theme of stopping, taking a look, and understanding what you need as opposed to what you think you want. it's wonderful. I love the fact that Naveen, being that he's more, or should I say, the fact that he's easily conned into, you know, thinking that he's going to get cast, is also the first one to understand his mistake. I like that part of the story, and I think that actually helps the overall theme. But again, you know, with Naveen, you know, he thinks he wants money because, you know, as you learn in the story, you know, he doesn't know what to do because he's had everything done before him and not understanding that what he needs is, you know, self-control and taking a look right before him and seeing, you know, that everything he wants is right before him. Tiana understanding, or should I say, Tiana's more difficult in the fact that, you know, she doesn't understand why her father wanted to open a restaurant and serve food. It wasn't just to make food. You know, it was because food, sort of in the spirit of what New Orleans is about itself when it comes to their food, you know, the idea that good food brings people together, which, again, that's a very New Orleans type of theme when you go down there. And again, I can't actually say that I've been in New Orleans, but I have a lot of friends who are from New Orleans and have, you know, told me similar stuff. So, you know, again, I'm going off that mindset. But again, that idea of it brings people together. And she just didn't understand that it was that idea of bringing family and friends together around good food. That's why he wanted to open the restaurant. And she had to have her eyes open to that. And sometimes it takes a journey to see, you know, to get away from everything and to be able to stop and see what you need is right in front of you. You know, and overall, I think it's a great sort of moral story that, by the way, is not hit, doesn't hit people over the head. It's not forced down our throats. You know, it feels organically flowing through the story. Is that overall theme of what you want against what you need. I mean, I think it's weaving perfectly through this sort of adventure story of this ticking clock. Next, we're going to talk about the romance with between Tiana and Naveen, which, again, I think it helps the overall theme because you have this other part of the story that gives you a breather. You know, you have three things that are big in this movie. You have, again, the overall theme and overall narrative of the movie. You have this romance between Tiana and Naveen, and, of course, you have the comedy. And each one is perfectly integrated into giving you a breather from the other part of the story and allows all three of them to be woven perfectly and organically throughout each other to make a great movie. And with the romance, Tiana, I think one of the great things is that you have this adventure that allows their feelings and their romance for each other to grow. Yeah, it happened over the span of 2 days, but still, there was this big, long adventure that gave them plenty of time for their feelings for each other and their, you know, romance to grow. As I said before, I love the fact that it's Naveen who first sees it, and you see it in that Evangeline song. To, you know, he's looking in the eyes, and he's understanding this woman is more than what she seems. And then, of course, to continue that, you know, later on, whether at Mama Odie's, you know, you see him slowly understand, I have feelings for this woman. I have feelings for this girl. You know, it, again, like I said, I like the fact that considering that, you know, he's the one who makes all the mistakes, he's the first one to understand what's right in front of him. And again, that's the whole point. You know, the fact that each one is what each needs, I think, is a very creative idea. You know, this idea that, you know, they both need these things that where you think of what they need, it doesn't seem like, oh, it would be this person, but it turns out to be that way because of who they are deep inside. So I very much love that part of the romance, and I think ultimately I love that sort of ticking clock part of the romance where towards the end, you know, Naveen, he's willing to get married to Charlotte LeBeau, and, you know, be kissed, you know, even though he loves Tiana. He's willing to sacrifice his happiness to, you know, for Tiana's happiness, and Tiana won't let it happen. And it's just the completion of that journey they very much like. And the fact that it does cause them being frogs, only for them to realize later, hey, if we get married, you're a princess now. hey, we're human. And I do like the smile, by the way, on Mama Odie's, because it's like, you know, I told y'all so. And which, by the way, that is a great line there where it goes, this gonna be good. Oh. Which, and again, while it may not have anything to do with sort of that romantic part of the story, the comedy in this movie, again, it gives you a breather from both the overall theme and the romance, you know. I love sort of, again, this is John Musker and Ron Clements. You know, these are the people who developed the three rules of comedy in the 90s when it comes to Disney. You know, anytime you need a joke, make a funny face, you drop somebody's pants, or you hit them in the head. That these guys are the ones who came up with those three rules. And you have them all in this movie. Ray, you know, just there are so many. Between Ray and Charlotte, I can't stop laughing. To where be Ray, you know, at the end of his sort of fight with the frog catcher, and he gets spit out the nose, sort of goes, I think I chipped my favorite tooth. he goes, we are far, far away. No way! You from Sheepo! Which is a joke only people in Louisiana get. I mean, I understand it. I had to have it explained to me. But, you know, after it being explained, you know, I got it. Thankfully, that explanation of that, because I actually heard that joke before this movie came out. So, I think I was lucky in the fact that I had heard that joke before and I had it explained to me. And so, when Ray says that line, I got it and immediately laughed. And by the way, there is a lot of sort of in Louisiana, in New Orleans jokes there. There's also a lot of sort of like things within the movie, which I'll talk about in a second. But again, also you have Charlotte, which anytime she's on screen cracks me up. You know, you have that first part in the shop to where, you know, it's like, tell him, Big Daddy, and then cuts him off. And then, of course, you have to see where he has enough and he just shoves the beignet in her mouth. But again, like I said, I think my favorite part is definitely at the end. That's my favorite line of hers, where, you know, she's dancing apparently with the prince's brother, and you don't see him. It's like, I didn't know the prince had a younger brother. How old did you say you were? I'm 9 and a half. I waited this long, and it cracks me up. It really does. And then, of course, all the different, you know, nods, you know, there are, you know, for instance, when the Fennel brothers get covered with cake, they're supposed to look like John Musker, they're supposed to be caricatures of John Musker and Ron Clements. The poop scooping guy, when Naveen is dancing with that band, you see that, manure scooping guy, that's supposed to be Eric Goldberg, the animator. And then, of course, you have, and these are just some of the things in the movie. A lot of times when you see the I'm trying to think, not a subway car, but sort of the rail car, there's a number on the front of it. That number is the same number for a class at Cal Arts that had not only, I believe it was Ron Clements, but it also had John Lessinger. I think it's Rob Minkoff. I'm blanking on a couple other guys who work for Pixar. All of these guys were in that Cal Arts class, and so if you look closely to a lot of their films, they'll have that number in there, and that's what it's referencing. So, what this has to do with romance of Tiana and Naveen, people might understand. But again, all of this is great stuff that gives you breather from that part of the story and from the overall theme. And again, I think that's the important part, is that all of this stuff is organically woven. So it doesn't feel like it's focused on one part of the story too long, and it doesn't feel like it's beating you over the head with some of the more morality stuff and things like that. It just makes it an enjoyable movie. Another way they do this is the fact that it is a Broadway-style story, and I love the fact that, especially when it comes to the song scenes, they're very much set up like a Broadway musical. You know, if you look at the way the scenes are set up and the way they move, you can see these scenes being on set. And again, like I said, it's just a style I think it works very well with Disney Animation, to where you're having these songs tell these important part of the story. You know? You get so much detail about why they're falling in love and why they're on their journey and about the con and everything through the songs. With that, we're going to move on to our final talking point. And I got to admit that this review's kind of been hard. Not because there isn't anything to talk about or anything to focus, but there's one part of this movie I really wanted to talk about. And it's one of those things to where, you know, I'm the type of person to where when I eat something, I don't eat my favorite thing first. I leave my favorite part of the meal at the end. And people are probably like, what the hell does this have to do with anything? But, you know, like, for instance, I'll make chicken cutlets. I'll leave the chicken cutlet to the end, and I'll have the corn and rice first, and then eat the chicken cutlets. There's one part of this movie I really was looking forward to talking about, because I feel it's very important. But it's been a struggle to get to it, because, like, oh, I gotta get through art and music and all that. Not that I don't love the music, and that I don't love the art, and don't love the story itself. But the final thing I want to talk about is sort of the discrimination of the Princess and the Frog. Now, I bring this up because it's something I completely agree with Doug Walker, who a lot of people know as a nostalgia critic. If you don't know, during December and sort of the first half of January, because he got a virus, he did Disney-cember, where he covered all of the sort of 2D hand-drawn Disney animation films, which included this, and he said something which I very much agree with and sort of want to, I've thought this for a long time, and he just was the first one saying I absolutely agree with him. But when I talk about the discrimination of The Princess and the Frog, I'm not necessarily saying that, oh, this film didn't do well because people don't like a black princess. That is far from the truth, though I'm sure there are some people out there who didn't want to see this because, you know, you had African-American princess. But I actually think that those people are, you can't even register them. They're so small in number. They'd be like, oh, 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 or excuse me, 0.0000001%. Now, when I talk about the discrimination that is The Princess and the Frog, I'm talking about its discrimination of being a 2D hand-drawn film. I think we've unfortunately become an age where a couple of things have happened. One, we've sort of regressed back towards that idea that, oh, 2D hand-drawn animation is just for kids. It's either for kids or it's this artsy adult stuff. It's not in between. It can't be for everyone. I think that has a huge impact on whether people did see this film. You know, we reverted to that because that's what it's been mostly used for the past couple of years. But more importantly, you know, because of the rise of CGI with things like Shrek and, of course, all the Pixar stuff. And, you know, I said Shrek before, but, you know, Shrek and the DreamWorks, you know, films that come out on a regular basis. And all the other, you know, sort of animated projects, you know, like from Sony to where you have, I'm trying to think of the Despicable Me that Sony released. And so you had all this stuff and things like Hoodwink and all, and all those titles. People are used to CG and used to CG being what Disney Animation proved in the 90s, which is that you can have 2D, or you can have animation, mind you, be this thing that works for everyone and actually cover mature subjects. You know, that was why we had such a rise of 2D hand-drawn animation and anime when it came on Toonami, is because it proved that point of animation can cover these deep, sort of more mature subjects. You know, that animation pretty much is for everyone. There's an animation for anyone out there. And now it's been sort of, because of the rise of CGI, you've had sort of 2D hand-drawn animation be bounce back to the idea that, oh, it's just for kids, or it's Or should I say, it's either just for kids, or it's that sort of artsy adult stuff. There is no between, which is very sad. But the other part of it is also sort of the discrimination against 2D hand-drawn, because it takes basically too much time. You know, I really think that the Disney executives didn't promote this movie right. And I say that because I think they really did want it to fail. I mean, I have no proof, and I know I'm going out on a limb here, but it's just the fact of, like, you look at Tangled, which was a good movie as well. Princess and the Frog and Tangled both kind of made around the same amount, and yet Princess and the Frog was deemed a failure. Why? Really for no other reason than it's a 2D hand-drawn animated film. And you got to understand that when these executives are looking about whether it's a success or not, they're not looking about how much necessarily it made, but about how much time it took to make the movie. They want to focus solely on CG because they're quick to make. They're easier to make, and they don't take much time. Hand-drawn takes patience. Hand-drawn takes time. Even if it costs the same amount, it takes twice the amount of time to do a hand-drawn animated film than it does a CG film. A CG film can be done in 9 months to a year. A hand-drawn, at its quickest, can be done in 2 years. Which, by the way, Beauty and the Beast was really done in the span of 2 years. And I believe that does include prep time. But, or at least animated-wise, it was animated in 2 years. But usually it takes, you know, 3 to 4 years. You know, for instance, with this movie, they started production in 2006, and it came out in 2009. So that's a 3-year process there. And not even, like, beginning of 2009, like, the end of 2009, and they started production at the beginning of 2006. So it's really more like 3 years and 11 months. But again, it takes time to make those films, and they don't want that. They don't want to take time with making these films. They want to pop these films out one after another because it would make them more money. It's not about what's successful and what makes the most money. It's about what costs them the most money. And I think that's really sad. It's a discrimination that's, I feel, is very unfair by Disney executives. And I only say on that standpoint that I'm very much glad that John Lasseter is in charge of Disney Animation, because he is so, you know, for all the facts that he brought in CG with Pixar and that stuff, he's also somebody who loves 2D hand-drawn animation, and it's continuously pushing for hand-drawn Disney animation. There is another part of this discrimination angle that's also there, and this does go more towards the race angle. But again, it's not that matter of that people don't like there being a black princess, but more of the fact that I think a lot of people, when they saw the promotions about this being, you know, the first black princess, I think a lot of people immediately thought, oh, this is a gimmick. And I really think that's what a lot of people started thinking. I think that did create a huge problem, you know. Instead of sort of having this normal thought process, because one of the things I didn't quite talk about, because I didn't go over really the race issue in this review, being that it was the first black princess, and part of the reason I did that is because of what the film did, which is it didn't really cover race or gender issues. And I say gender issues because it did take place in the 1900s. I mean, really, there's only one place where sort of race and the gender issues that were really prevalent in the 1900s were sort of brought to light, and that was at the party where the Fennel brothers were telling Tiana that somebody had outbid her, and they were trying to convince her, and, you know, he uses that line of somebody of your stature would have a hard time, you know, running that restaurant. You know, that's really the only time it was brought up, but for the most part, Disney handled her as if she was any other person, as if race wasn't an issue at all. And I actually really like that. There's a focus on her being a complete character and person rather than using her race as a gimmick, which, unfortunately, a lot of people thought. You know, a lot of people thought and went into this, and they either had one or two thoughts. I'm like, oh, that's not the way black people act. They got this all wrong. Or they watch scenes and like, oh, but that's just a gimmick. That's just a gimmick. That's just a gimmick. And it immediately had people thinking about stereotypes and it being a gimmick, which was really, I feel, detrimental to this film. I think that hurt it in such a way that, you know, there were a lot of people thinking, and while watching that, oh, this is a gimmick, you know, that's not the way they act, and what's happening here. You know, sort of the same thing they did with Pocahontas, where, oh, well, this is not historically accurate. It's a Disney film! You know, I'm sorry, this is supposed to be a Disney film for all ages. They're not gonna go into the sort of the yes, it's sad the way white settlers from England treated the Indians. But this is not the place to talk about with children. It's supposed to be an entertaining movie. You want to talk to your children afterwards? Talk to it. Same thing here. It's not the place to talk about race relations. You know, this is supposed to be a fun, entertaining fairy tale. It's more of a matter, and I know George Carlin, God rest his soul, is going to hate me for using this word, but it's not a matter of that she is a black princess. It's a matter of that she's a princess who happens to be African-American. What's more important is the character and the way she acts. And and that's the way Disney treats them, as if they're just any other person. And I actually enjoy that. I see the same thing with, you know, I'm a big comic book fan with Ultimate Spider-Man. They have a new Spider-Man, Ultimate Spider-Man, a new character named Miles Morales, who's half black, half Hispanic. And they don't, you know, and he's also from Harlem. But rather going to the stereotypes that people might think of somebody of that ethnicity and being in that part of New York, they treat him as if he's any other normal kid with problems and that stuff that we can, and it helps us really connect with him. And I love that. I love that they treat him as a person rather than a stereotype and a gimmick. And yet, unfortunately, because there's a lot of promotion about it being, you know, the first black princess, you know, you had a lot of people thinking it's gonna be nothing but a gimmick, and so they didn't go see it, you know. And I think that really hurt, and that was discrimination in a way too. So, you know, all those things of sort of the idea that, oh, this is just a gimmick, along with sort of the fall, shall we say, of 2D animation, because people have revert back thinking that, oh, 2D animation is just for kids, and for the fact that, you know, Disney executives don't want to take the time to do the work, or at least they don't want to wait for, you know, Disney to do the work, no matter how good it is, you know, I think really hurt the sales and sort of the outlook of this film in general. You know, and I knew when I started seeing that this was happening, when a couple of months after The Princess and the Frog came out, Disney executives came out and said they didn't really look at The Princess and the Frog as a success. And their reasoning was that the age group of 6 to 8 year old little boys didn't do well. I want everybody to think about that for a second. You're looking at the success of a Disney princess fairy tale film, and you're judging its success. I'm like stumbling over that word there, but you're judging its success over how well it did with 6 to 8 year old little boys. The same people that no matter what the film is on the big screen, whether it be a big action movie or a princess film, don't sit well in their seats because they want to go out and play in mud and everything like that. Really? You're judging the success on that? You know, again, I told you the story last week about, you know, how Part of Your World almost didn't make it into the movie of The Little Mermaid because a little boy who apparently had ADD or something dropped his popcorn and was focused on cleaning it up, and Jeffrey Katzenberg took this as a sign as the song was boring, which I think we all knew was completely ridiculous. And that's the same thing here. It's completely ridiculous to sort of judge a prince, of all things, a princess movie whose main target audience as little girls and people who love 2D animation on 6 to 8 year old little boys. It's ridiculous. See why I'm angry about this? And I'm angry about this and I'll sort of translate into my final thoughts on the film, because I love this film. This is a wonderful film. It's done great. Is it Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, and Aladdin great? That sort of platinum level? No, but it's on that same level of Lion King. Well, I guess Lion King should be put in the platinum era, but I think, you know, when you think of Pocahontas and Hunchback of Notre Dame and Mulan, and those, you know, it's that level just below things like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, Lion King, and Little Mermaid. And I certainly think this could be a great jumping off point into doing more hand-drawn animated films. I've recently read somewhere that they do want to continue doing hand-drawn, and they want to try to make it to where you have every 2 years a new Disney hand-drawn animated, which I'd love to see, no matter what it is. At the end of the day, I think this is a must-have. It's a wonderful movie, especially if you're a Disney collector, but even if you aren't, you should watch this movie because it's wonderful, the songs are beautiful, the animation is wonderful, and it's just an overall wonderful movie. So that's it for my review of Disney's The Princess and the Frog. Have any comments? You know, we're disagree, agree, you want to leave me, hate mail fam, or whatever. Remember, unless you tell me you don't want me to, I will read any comment on the air. Remember that you can do that several ways. You can leave comments on the site, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. You can also leave us email at absolution132@yahoo.com. That's absolution132@yahoo.com. That's the way you can email us. And mind you, the 132 is in numbers. And again, I am working on getting iTunes, as I may mention before. I need to work on that, so I apologize. Of course, remember to check out all my other podcasts on the other 132 production sites I cover, which includes Tokyo SOS, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, Comic Book Crazy and Hexcast, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. Of course, check out all the friends of the show, like Michael Bailey's Views from the Lone Box and From Crisis to Crisis, Brad Douglas's Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Slacker's Major Spoilers, or Scott Gardner's 2-2 Freaks, and, of course, all our other friends. You can find them on the sidebar. And that's it for this week's show. Next week, we close out Disney Month here at the Absolution Network. And what better way to close it out than to cover the most perfect animated movie of all times? Yes, that's right. Next week, we cover what is not only probably the most perfect animated movie of all time, but my favorite movie of all time. Or at least tied with Who Framed Roger Rabbit. That's right, next week we cover Beauty and the Beast. So until next time, my Tsunami Generation, stay golden.
A cursed samurai. You have succeeded again in eluding my effort. But I am not worried. For one day you will fail.
By DJ Clark Nova. Don't sleep on it.